Stage, it's about time for us going to get started this evening. Who can tell me what we were talking about last on Sunday morning? What period were we studying? Okay, we're talking about the period of the Exodus. We spent quite a bit, or pretty much all of Sunday morning, going through doing a review of the book of Exodus. It kind of worked out pretty well. A couple weeks before, we had taken the opportunity to go through and really dig in and discover the outline for Genesis. And we broke it down even further than what we have in the book into what we were able to go through and even identify the periods of the outline for the for Genesis, sorry, even including the period of the patriarchs and stuff as well. With the book of Exodus, we've kind of gone along with cycle three, done the same thing. We've taken the opportunity to go through and really discuss some more stories again. A lot of stories we've talked about so far really haven't been anything it's not new. It's stuff we touched on briefly in cycle one. We went over and kind of discussed them again on cycle two. And then with cycle three, we're going through kind of fleshing it out a little bit more. And again, just kind of moving over, refreshing those stories, keeping them fresh in our minds, and make sure we remember which box we put them in. Which of the 17 periods do these box stories fit in? Now, we went through on Sunday morning, we kind of wrapped up with the book of Exodus, and we left off with the nation of Israel. They're receiving the instructions and stuff, and they'd already received the instructions for how to build the tabernacle. But now it was time for them actually to build it. How many individuals did God set over to oversee this building, the construction of the tabernacle? Two, okay, very good. So he gave two individuals to be oversight, to oversee the building of that tabernacle. More importantly, he gave them the knowledge and instructions that they needed in order to build it according to how God prescribed. With anything God has given us, as far as instructions, commandments, as far as our faith, or obedience, or how to worship Him, does God leave things open to chance or open to question? He's always given us specific instructions on what we need to do, how we're to do it, and like I said, for most stuff in the Scripture, we can find either direct command or examples, biblical examples of how it was accomplished, how it was completed, so that way we have no excuse on our end to turn around and say, well, I just didn't know, so I went ahead and just did my best job. Our best intentions aren't always going to be what's right in the sight of God. What's right in the sight of God is what God has commanded us to do. And so that's what, again, time and time again throughout the Scriptures, was building the ark, building the tabernacle, anything God gives with instructions, He's pretty specific. And then we left off with the question I presented to you is, why is the tabernacle not put to immediate use at this time? We close out the book of Exodus, but we have a tabernacle, we have everything we need, all the instruments, all the furniture is there. Why is the tabernacle not put to immediate use? What's the holdup? What do we not have? Okay, I haven't crossed the Jordan, but something prior to that. Okay, we need what? To be consecrated. We need some priests, okay? Up to this point, God's been talking directly with Moses, and Moses has been handling guarding the people, but when God's given these specific instructions, He's given orders to have priests, and we don't have priests at this time. And so that's why we go into beginning the book of Leviticus, chapters 1 through 7, is regarding what? Okay? We're still leading up to the priests being consecrated, but in order for them to be able to carry out the acts of worship, they need to know what? They need to know the laws as far as regarding the offerings. So turn with me over to the book of Leviticus, and let's flip through chapters 1 through 7. Let's take a few seconds to go through, and we'll see here. We start out with chapter 1. It's the law of what? Burnt offerings. And then we go on. We also read of in chapter 2. It moves on. See chapter 2, the law of grain offerings. Chapter 3, the law of peace offerings. Again, flip it through your book, your Bible. Chapter 4, the law of sin offerings. And then chapter 5, the law of guilt offerings. And then when we get to chapter 7, we start to see some more actual involvement. Where does the priest's involvement fall when it comes to the offerings? And then finally in chapter 8... I'm sorry, I left out my other question I had for you. Okay, up to this point, who had been making these offerings? Who's the one that was presenting the offerings to God up to this point? Okay, we have Moses making offerings up to God. And so we move on into Leviticus chapter 8, where we have now the priesthood is established with the tribe of Levi. Very good. So the tribe of Levi, and so we have the consecration of Aaron and his sons. And so we read about that in chapter 8. So now we have a completed tabernacle. We have the laws of which we need to follow as far as how to make the offerings, what we're supposed to do, the act of giving, providing these offerings to God. And now with chapter 8 and the consecration of Aaron and his sons, we now have the ability for them to make the offerings. Now, before they were, how were they consecrated? What was some of the action, what were the activities or the process that they went through? Remember, they were put aside and they were set in the tent for how many days? For 7 days, okay? They were set aside for 7 days, and Moses came forward and he presented them according to the command of God. And at that point, they're able to now start offering sacrifices, which we see in Leviticus chapter 9, when Aaron starts offering sacrifices. Now, this is pretty much an important time, turn of events in the nation of Israel, because again, everything had been coming through Moses. Now we have Aaron and his sons also having the ability and the command of God to be able to offer sacrifices. Now, what do we read of in chapter 10? Okay, we have the story of Nadab and Abihu. Okay, now here they are. They've been given the instructions that God's commanded. Again, God didn't leave out any details on what was acceptable, what was not acceptable, what was supposed to be done, and he didn't leave anything for chance. But what happened with Nadab and Abihu? What did they do? Okay, they utilized strange fire in their offering to God. What was God's reaction to this? He was very unpleased, okay? He didn't turn around and cut them any slack. He said, oh, you know, they're just beginners. They'll warm up to the idea. They'll get the idea, and then they'll kind of get back to where they're... Here we are. They've been consecrated. They've been set aside as the priests. The nation is looking to them for their example. The nation is looking to them on what they're supposed to be doing, what they're not supposed to be doing, how they're supposed to perform the act of sacrifice properly. Can God leave that example to chance as well? No, again, he gave specific instructions. He gave them the knowledge, the understanding that they needed, but by them offering the foreign fire, strange fire, could God just kind of turn a blind eye and just let it kind of pass on through that time and hope they'll do better next time? No. Again, with God, the blessings are countless. The blessings are great, but with those blessings and those opportunities that we have, there also comes what? Responsibility and knowledge and understanding. So again, we see where they're immediately killed. They're put to death. And so we go on, and the rest of the book of Leviticus is really going through instructions and laws, a lot of it pertaining to, again, your daily lives. Look through in chapter 11. You get the laws about animals for food. Okay, chapter 12, the laws of motherhood. Chapter 13, the test for leprosy. Chapter 14, the law of cleansing a leper. Chapter 15, cleansing unhealthiness. Chapter 16. Law of Atonement. Now, see, again, a lot of this stuff isn't really pertaining to the actual sacrifice or worship to God, but again, it's pertaining to their daily lives and what they need to do. And a lot of this information, again, is not only good and pleasing in the sight of God, but it also helps them to make sure they're living according to God's Word. This is also helping to provide them for a healthy lifestyle, help them to have a good moral system in order to not only present before their own people, the nation of Israel, but also for those around them, can also see them as an example as being God's chosen people. Does this also apply to us today? Quiet class tonight. Exactly. Obviously, we don't have the old law to live by, but again, when we go out in the world and we're presented out in the world, not only do we want to make sure we're living by the laws of the land, but again, we're set apart. We're set apart for God's use. And so in doing that, we should be able to be the ones out there to be that beacon in the world. That we should be the one by our example to see if they see us as being different. Difference probably being a good thing in today's nation. In today's state of affairs, as far as you look at the morals of the country, the morals of the world, do we want to align ourselves with those morals, or do we want to make sure we set ourselves apart? By which standard are we measuring our success? Is it by the standard of the world, or is it by the standard that God has laid out before us? So again, we need to make sure that in our actions, even today, just as it was back then, we need to make sure we are set apart, and we're set apart for God's use. Continuing on through the rest of Leviticus, chapter 17, blood for atonement. Chapter 18, the laws of immoral relations. 19, idolatry forbidden. 20, human sacrifice and immoralities. 21, regulations concerning priests. God, again, he's not leaving anything for chance. He's pretty much covering all the bases. He's trying to cover all the areas as far as someone coming up and saying, I have a question regarding this. Well, he's giving them instruction on what they're to do, what they're not to do, and how they behave and react to certain situations. So the rest of Leviticus, again, goes through, and it's just instruction after instruction from God on how to live a godly life, how to be right in the sight of God. Now we go from Leviticus into what book? The book of Numbers, okay. So, Numbers chapter 1, we see where there's a census taken, where they go through and they gather up the number of Israel's warriors. Which tribe was not numbered among this census? Okay, I got the tribe of Levi. Were they not fit to carry out war? Were they not physically able to carry out, to join the others? Okay, again, that they had been set aside for the purpose of the priesthood. So in doing that, they couldn't be counted among the warriors of Israel. Again, not because they had some inadequacy that they couldn't go out and wield a sword just like anybody else, but it was more so because they had been set aside for the purpose of being a purpose of ministry, exactly. And so without mixing the two of them together, again, you had the warriors and you had the priesthood. Numbers chapter 2, we have the arrangement of Israel's camps. Okay? So again, we're further. God's helping to kind of get things lined up. Now, how were they arranged? How were they distinguished? By what? Okay. Pretty simple. They already had 12 tribes. They already had things, something working for them. So rather than complicate it any further, they kept them established, arranged by camps. Numbers chapter 3, again, we see where it talks about further the tribe of Levi being set aside for the priesthood, for the ministry of God. Once we move on past chapter 3, okay, before I go too far in term, sorry, look back on chapter 3, verses 44 through 48. Chapter 3, verses 44 through 48. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel and the cattle of the Levites, and the Levites shall be mine, I am the Lord, for the ransom of the 273 of the firstborn of the sons of Israel who are in excess beyond the Levites. You shall take 5 shekels apiece per head. You shall take them in the terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, the shekel in 20 gerahs, and give the money, the ransom of those who are in excess among them, to Aaron and his sons. So Moses took the ransom money from those who were in excess beyond the ransom by the Levites. From the firstborn of the sons of Israel, he took the money in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, 1,365. So again, this goes back to what? Where does this originate from? We talked about last Sunday morning. We had the Passover, and after the Passover, God said, you're going to consecrate unto me, what? The firstborn, okay? So again, they were spared as far as their life being spared, but again, he expected them to be consecrated to be his service. And so we see that by that, he's helping to also provide for the tribe of Levi, to help provide for Aaron and his sons, because again, their sole purpose is to do what day in and day out? Was it to go out and provide for themselves? Was it to go out and gather, build, fight? What was their sole purpose? Ministry of God. Again, so here we see where God's also providing for those who minister to him. Numbers chapter 9, God commands Israel to partake of the Passover. So, Numbers chapter 9. Verses 1 through 3. Thus says the Lord, thus the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai. Again, they're still at Mount Sinai at this point. In the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, Now let the sons of Israel observe the Passover as its appointed time. On the 14th day of this month, at twilight, you shall observe it as it is appointed time. You shall observe it according to all the statutes and according to all the ordinances. Okay, so God's commanded them, say, hey, this is the appointed time now. As far as a reference of time, what else did he point out? From this point, it's been what? 1 year. Okay, so we go on in Numbers chapter 10. Now the nation of Israel is actually on the move again. Now if we remember back in Exodus, he said, well, it's time for you guys, it's time to start moving on. But they didn't immediately move out because what were they doing? After they received that instruction, they finished building the tabernacle. Okay, now we see in Numbers chapter 10, feet are actually pounding the ground. They're starting to move out. And they didn't move all, did they move out all in one big group? Or how did they move out? And tribes by their camp. Again, they're all divided by the camp, so they're divided and moved out by their camp. So again, verses 11 through 11 and 12 of chapter 10. Now in the second year, in the second month of the 20th of that month, the cloud was lifted up from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the sons of Israel set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai, and then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they left Egypt. They traveled, they came to Mount Sinai, and they were there for quite a while. And now it's time for them to actually move on to where? They're just moving on to another resting stop somewhere else? Where are they moving on to at this point? Okay, they're heading towards Kadesh Barnea. They're heading towards the land of Canaan, the land that was promised to them. There's time for them to go and take the reward that God had promised to them. Numbers chapter 11, we have the murmuring of the people. I know we talked about this quite a bit on Sunday. The nation of Israel was very, very fickle. Even after God had turned around and provided for them, provided a relief, got them out of Egypt, provided them a way of escape, they still did what? They murmured, they complained. And a lot of times when they're complaining, what were they complaining about? Physical things. They had a little rumbling in their tummy, and they just cried out saying, oh, the end is near, we were better off in Egypt, why did you even bring us out of the land of Egypt? Everything was so much better in Egypt. Now, what was their attitude when they were in Egypt? They couldn't have thought of a worse place to live. They're like, how can we be here? We're slaves, we're oppressed. They cried out to God time and time again. They cried out to God, finally heard their cries, their pleas, and he sent them Moses. But while they're there, they said, this is the worst place ever. Once they're left and their stomach starts to grumbling a little bit now, I'll be the first to admit, if I miss a meal, I get a little cranky. But again, it's going to take quite a few meals for me to want to speak out against God and blaspheme God. Whereas the nation of Israel, the first thing they did is they cried out against Moses. They cried out against God. Well, how could you do this to us? Even though he had time and time again provided to them signs, miracles, wonders, proof of his authority, they still would always just cry and murmur to God through Moses. I think also I pointed out on Sunday is, who here would have liked to volunteer for the job of Moses? Or actually, let's further refine that question. Who here thinks they would have qualified with regards to patience to be Moses' replacement? Okay, I know it certainly wouldn't have been me. How he could turn around and listen to them complain. He'd go and he'd pray God on their behalf, intercede on their behalf. I'd have been, no, go ahead, take what you need, God. Clean out the rest of the ones that are crying and whining, take them out of here. We'll keep the good ones behind. I'll help lead the rest of them, the way. But he always interceded and treated God to save them. What was one of the main reasons Moses, a lot of times, he offered up to God why he should not turn around and just wipe them out? What was one of the reasons he kept using over and over again? He says, okay, exactly. And so we see where, again, he entreats them, but the people continually, they murmur against God. It's amazing. Sometimes I read through this and I'm like, whew. Between God and Moses having that amount of patience, I don't see it. But again, that's why I'm not in Moses' position. But again, you have to look at Moses, his patience and his faith in God, and really truly admire the patience that he has shown. Chapter 11 was about murmuring. Anyone like to take a guess what chapter 12 is about? Oh, there it is again. It's like a broken record. The murmuring again. So now we have the murmuring, not only the people, but who's murmuring now? Okay, we got Miriam and Aaron. Now, would you have expected that from Miriam and Aaron? Of the people? Yes, you probably would expect that, especially considering the track record they have prior to this. But Miriam and Aaron murmur out. And so, what was the response that we see to that? Okay. God strikes them with Miriam with leprosy, okay? When God turned around and came to them and presented, he called them out for the tent of the meeting. Let's pick up in chapter 12, verse 5. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of a cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent. And he called Aaron and Miriam, and they stood at, and when they had both come forward, he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with Moses, not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, and not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses?" Okay, so God pretty much lays it all out in the line right there, makes it clear without any question why Moses has been chosen and why they were not. He lays out before them that Moses is the selected one, not so much you. And so he said, "Well, you're not going to speak these things against me. Why would you speak these things against my servant Moses?" And he shows himself to be very akin, very close to Moses, even to a point where they speak openly, mouth to mouth. There isn't any question. There's no differentiation. No differentiation there. He says, "The relationship I have with Moses, he is my servant. Among all my household, he's the one." Is that the same description he gives to Aaron and Miriam? No. And so we see again, Miriam struck with leprosy. Numbers chapter 13 comes to the point where we're now coming to the end of what period? Wandering in the wilderness, okay? Chapter 13, we learn about the spies being sent out into the land. Again, I think most everybody here, without question, knows the story of the spies being sent out. So again, that brings us to the close of the Exodus. Now we're coming into the wandering in the wilderness. The wandering in the wilderness, what events mark the beginning and what event marks the end of this period? The beginning begins with what? Okay, the give their report, and what happens when they get that report?
Everybody gets down.
Okay, everybody cries out, and once again they begin their murmuring, crying out to God, "I can't believe you brought us out this far just to let us die." God hears their pleas, and they said, and then once again, they throw out their excuse. "It was so much better where?" And back in Egypt. Here we go. Time and time again, they keep throwing that back at God, and God finally says, he hears them, what does he do? He convicts them to what? Wander in the wilderness. And then what was the end of the period marked with? What marked the end of the period of the wandering in the wilderness? Okay, they crossed the Jordan. Very good. So we have the period starts with who leading the people? Moses, okay. Who is the individual who leads the people at the end of the? Joshua, very good. Okay, and then what books contain the period of the judges? Period of the wandering in the wilderness. In Numbers 14 through 36. Again, open book test, folks, so feel free to answer. Deuteronomy and Joshua 1 through 5. Very good. Okay, so we start off in Numbers chapter 14, verses 3 and 4. Here we go. Let the murmuring begin. Excuse me. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first and second month in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take the census of all the congregation, the sons of Israel."
much more effective reading from on the right chapter. There we go. Then all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried out, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" Okay. Verses 6 through 8, though, we see a stark contrast. That's pretty much the entire nation saying this, but we have two individuals standing up and saying, "No, no, 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 no." Quite the contrary. Yes, there's foes ahead of us. There's great walled cities, the giants, but they knew, with their faith in God and God being able to provide for them, they would be able to obtain the land without any question. So we have the faith shown and demonstrated by Joshua and Caleb pleading with the people, saying, "No, don't cry. We can take this land." Who did they listen to? Who did the nation listen to? They listen to the two, or do they listen to the ten? Okay. Go to show the majority isn't always right. Verses 21 through 23, we read where God gives them their sentence. Verses 21. The Lord said, "I have pardoned them according to your word, but indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it." Okay? So here we see that they're sentenced to wander in the wilderness, because they're at the doorstep of the land for them to go in. They cried out, they wouldn't go in, so God turned around and tells them, "No, now you have to move on, because those of you had kept testing me time and time again, even though you can see it now, you'll never be able to enter into it." Number 16, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Now again, what would this fall under? What category would this fall under? Grumbling, murmuring, rebellion. Again, time and time again. Talked about this quite a bit when we're going through discussing the second cycle. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, what was their sin? What were they wanting to do? Okay, they didn't respect the consecration of the priesthood. They thought that, hey, we were just as good as them. And the result of their rebellion was? Okay, just swallowed up by the earth. It was by no means could be defined as an ordinary death. Definitely strange, different, something that's probably never been done before or after that point. They're swallowed up by the earth. A great display of God's ability, His command, His authority is shown there before the nation of Israel. How many here would have taken notice? Okay? If I'd have saw, been an eyewitness, it wasn't something like I saw on the TV news or on the internet. It was something you saw, you were an eyewitness to. There was no question about it, it happened. What do we read about the very next day? Okay, just repeat that answer over and over again, because it's probably a pretty good chance it's going to be the correct answer. Next day, we had the murmuring continues. God sends a plague upon them. 14,700 individuals die because of this murmuring. Okay? Does this mean that God doesn't love the nation of Israel? That He didn't care for them? Exactly. Your patience gives out after a while. And as we pointed out before, with great blessings and love and everything God provided to them, what did he want back from them? Did He expect great riches and stuff back from them? What did He expect back from them? Obedience. Okay? Obedience. Faith. That's all He asked for from them. They couldn't even provide that to Him. And so we have the very next day, murmuring continues, 14,700 people die because of their murmuring and disbelief in God. Numbers chapter 17, we have the story of Aaron's rod that buds, okay? Again, this is another opportunity God's taking to present
to the people, who has he selected to be the priest? Who has he selected to be the consecrated ones? Okay? What was the story behind Aaron's rod? We had how many individuals? We had what? Everybody was supposed to bring what? One rod, one staff. One from each tribe. Okay? They're all going to be collected up and put where? Okay? Inside the tent with the ark. And then they go back the next morning. There's going to be something different about one of them. Okay, very good. Now we talked about last time we were going through the second cycle. It wasn't so much that he had gone out and picked a fresh rod and he set it in there because he knew he was trying to prove his chances. Everybody set their rods in there, and not only did it blossom or put out a shoot and blossom, there was a ripened almond on there. So again, no questions about it. God had selected Aaron's rod, signifying he was the one selected. He was the one identified, called out by God. Numbers chapter 20. When you look at Numbers chapter 20, how many verses are in that chapter? Sorry? Okay, 29 verses. It's not a very big chapter when you look at it compared to some of the other books in the chapter, books in the Bible, the scriptures. But there is quite a bit that takes place and happens within this one chapter. We begin with the death of Miriam. What else happens in chapter 20? Okay, we have the sin of Moses and Aaron, the water of Meribah. Okay, verses 8 through 13. It's one of them events where, like I said, I think it's worth taking the time to look and read. And again, look at the example. Just as the patience of God gives out, obviously we see here with the patience of Moses, time and time again having to listen to the murmuring of the people, and it finally takes its toll on Moses, and his reaction, his behavior, is not becoming of what God had asked or expected of Moses. Verse 8, take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before the eyes, before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water from this out of this rock? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with the rod, and he went, water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. Time and time again, the nation, the people, murmured out, cried out, putting Moses' patience to the test. And finally, we see where just this one instance, although God really considered Moses to be very close kin to him, this one instance of Moses not carrying out God's command the way he had prescribed, what was God's reaction? Okay, he was punished. Again, God's not going to turn around and turn a blind eye to his sin when he's giving you instruction, specific instruction on how something's to occur, to be carried out. And so we have Moses has now been punished by saying, hey, you're not allowed to enter into the land. You're not going to be the one leading the people into the land which I had promised. Verses 14 through 21, we read of the passing by of Edom. And then verses 23 through 29, we have the death of Aaron. So again, death of Miriam, the waters of Meribah, the sin of Moses and Aaron, passing by Edom, and the death of Aaron. All this taking place within just 29 verses, the one book of Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 21. Actually, I'll close that up again. What do you think we're going to find in Numbers chapter 21? Murmuring, grumbling, rebellion. Okay, all three good answers. So we have, again, more grumbling, and what did the Lord do this time? He turned around and sent fiery serpents. Very good. And so what was God's instructions to Moses to help rectify this. How are the people going to be protected from these fiery serpents? What needed to happen? Okay, look at the brazen serpent. As long as they looked upon that brazen serpent, if they were bit, it didn't matter. As long as they looked upon that, they would be saved. They wouldn't die. If they weren't, if they didn't believe in God, believe in His instruction, if they were bitten, they fell down dead. So again, God giving them punishment for their actions, their behavior, but He always also provided a way of escape, a way to rectify yourself. And He did that with just looking on that serpent, the brazen serpent. Numbers chapter 22, story of Balaam and his donkey. All is still falling with the book, book of Numbers. And then finally, Numbers 25, we read of Israel's disobedience. We have the Midianite wives and idol worship. Now, had God given permission or instruction to Israel for them to marry foreign wives? Absolutely not. They were not to. They were given specific instructions not to do that. Why were they not to take foreign wives? Okay, exactly what we have right here. Taking on the foreign wife, of course that foreign wife's going to come in and she's going to bring with her her experience, her knowledge, her beliefs. Her beliefs, if she's not being of the nation of God, is probably going to be something other than a belief in God, which is going to be idol worship. And as we point out from time to time again, men have an inherent desire to please their wives, keep them happy. And sometimes in doing so, we see where they're themselves led astray because of their trying to appease their wives. God giving them specific instructions on the front end saying, do not take from yourself wives of the foreign lands, because He knew this very thing would happen. Numbers chapter 26, we have the second census taken of the nation of Israel. So the time's gone by, we have the second census taken, and what do we find at the occurrence of the second census? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. All dead with the exception of? Okay, Caleb and Joshua. Very good. Numbers chapter 27. We see, turn with me over to verses 15 through 23. We can see now where God's appointed Joshua to be the next leader. Numbers 27, verse 15. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, may the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom the spirit is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. You shall put some of your authority on him in order that all the congregation and the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar, the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. And at his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, before he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. Moses did just as the Lord commanded, and he took Joshua, set him before Eleazar, the priest, before all the congregation. And there he laid his hands on him and commissioned him, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. So again, we see where plans have been made. We know that Moses is going to be the one to bring the people into the land. Well, who's going to guard? Who's going to be the one to lead them? God making means, he points Joshua to be that individual. Numbers chapter 31, we see the slaughter of Midian. Okay? What were they commanded to do? To go out and do what? Okay? They're utterly destroy them, to get rid of them, to wipe them out because God's anger towards them. But what happened in verses 15 through 18? Look over in chapter 31, verses 15 through 18. Were they all utterly destroyed? No, they brought back what? Brought back the women. Now, Let's go back to the beginning. In chapter 25, we have the Israel's disobedience because they were doing what with the Midianite women? They were taking them and marrying them. They're joining themselves to the Midianite women. And because of that, participating in the idol worship. And it was that idol worship that was what? Raising the anger of the Lord against the Midianites. So they're given instructions to go out and do away with the Midianites. And they bring back the very thing that got them in that position to begin with, the women. And so we see that many of the women were brought back, but some of them were actually end up being put to death. Some were left behind, but those who were specified by the Lord. Brings us into Deuteronomy. So we leave Numbers, come into Deuteronomy. What is the book of Deuteronomy about? Okay, so this is his farewell address, his last chance, his opportunity to give the final speeches of Moses. What was the point of these final speeches? I mean, this is all information that Moses already presented once to them. Why was he needing to represent it? Okay, exactly. He has given them the opportunity again to give them a recounting of the laws for Israel's remembrance. He knew he wasn't going to be there with them crossing over the Jordan, leading them into the land, and continue to be the one there to provide them with the knowledge and instruction. He wanted to give them, again, a recounting of the law and impress upon them the importance of the laws and their obedience to the laws. Chapter 34, Deuteronomy, we read of the death of Moses. Turn with me to chapter 34. And I think as we talked about this when we were going through the second cycle again, Moses taking this opportunity to do his final speeches, I kind of compare it to a father or a parent knowing that their time is coming to an end. What does an individual who's kind of coming to the end, what do they usually want to do for their children? What do they want to do? They want to help kind of set the pace. They want to give them, pass upon them any of the knowledge or instructions that they know which help guide them through life. Also pass it on to them to make sure they remember these things. Moses, here he is, he carried the people out of the land of Egypt, even though they tried him and tested him and put his patience to the test each time. He still had a love and adoration for the nation of Israel because they were God's chosen people. And so again, he still had a great concern for their religious faith. And so he wanted to make sure that they were firm in their faith in God. And that's a lot of the reason behind his final speeches. Again, chapters 34, verse 9. Now Joshua the son of Nun was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord commanded Moses. Okay, so again, we see where Moses passes on. We had Joshua now taking the lead. But then I think it's important, too, we go back and we look again at verses 10 through 12. And it really goes back and solidifies the importance of Moses' relationship with God. Since that time, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, for all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent to him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, all his servants in his land, for all the mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. So again, there was no one else like Moses. We come to the book of Joshua. Chapter 1, we see where, again, Joshua has assumed command. He's the one now leading the people. Chapter 2, the story of Rahab sheltering the spies. Okay? These are the same spies that were sent out before? No, okay. They weren't just hiding this all this time, 42 years in the wilderness. These ones are the ones that got left behind. These ones are two new spies that were sent out to go spy out the land because... What's the point of spying out the land? Okay. They know that there is this time they're really ready to go in and take the land. And so you're not going to go in and try and take the land without first going out and seeing what you're up against. What was the difference between Israel's attitude the first time they sent out the spies versus the second time they sent out the spies? Did they believe that they could take the land this time? Absolutely. I don't think many of them were really willing to go ahead and take another 40 years out in the wilderness. They're ready to move on. And so chapter 3, we see where Israel crosses the Jordan. a lot better progression we had than the first try. We have then actually moving forward into the land. Exactly. Exactly. Like I said, he was there before, and so he already had knowledge, understanding, and most importantly, he had the faith that God could provide the way, the means for them to go ahead and take the land. They crossed the Jordan. Chapter 4, we read the memorial stones. We talked about this in cycle 2. They had how many stones? 12 stones, and they represented what? Okay, each tribe, and that the stones would be there as a memorial, so that way if a son and a father passed by, he could ask, what do those represent? And they represented what? Okay, how God brought the people out and delivered them. Chapter 5, the circumcision and the Passover observed. Okay, so that pretty much brings us through the end of the period of wandering in the wilderness. And you're saved by the bell, so no pop quiz today. Thank you very much.